Chapter 9. Houston, Texas. Tom Parker never knew what he was getting himself into when he joined NASA. In his defense, he'd grown up in rural Vermont, and his parents never had a television because the reception on the side of the mountain where they raised dairy cows was terrible. He knew something was up on his first day at the Johnson Space Center when his secretary placed a beautiful blown glass bottle on the credenza behind his desk and said it was for Jeannie. He'd asked her to explain, and when she realized he had no clue as to Jeannie's identity, she'd chuckled and said cryptically that he'd soon find out. Next came a pair of hand-painted bellows delivered anonymously to his office. Again, Parker didn't know what this meant and asked for an explanation. By now, several other women in the secretarial pool knew of his ignorance, as did his supervisor, an Air Force colonel who was a deputy director in the astronaut training program. The last piece of the puzzle was an autographed picture of a man in his mid to late 50s, with receding red hair and bright blue eyes. It took Parker a while to figure out that the signature was that of Hayden Rourke. Internet research was at its infancy then, so he had to rely on a local library. This led him to eventually discover that Rourke was an actor who played a NASA psychiatrist named Alfred Bellows, who was continually vexed by astronaut Anthony Nelson and the genie he'd found on a beach. Dr. Tom Parker was a NASA psychiatrist, and the I Dream of Jeannie jokes never stopped. After almost 10 years with the program, Parker had dozens of glass bottles similar to the one Jeannie called home, as well as autographed pictures of most of the cast and several of Sidney Sheldon's scripts. He adjusted the webcam on top of his laptop to accommodate the request of Bill Harris, his current patient.
"That's better," Harris said from Wilson George. "I was seeing a picture of Larry Hagman, but hearing your voice."
"He's better looking, at least," Parker quipped. "Leave the camera on Barbara Eden and you'll make my day." "So we were talking about the other members of your team. You leave Antarctica in a couple of days. What's their mood?"
"Disappointed, actually," the astronaut said. "A front's closed in on us. The weather boys at McMurdo say it's only going to last a few days, but we've all seen the data. The storm's covering damn near all of Antarctica. We're sucked in for a week or more, and then it'll take a few more days to clear their runway and ours."
"How do you feel about it?" Parker asked. He and the former test pilot had spoken enough over the past months to have an honest dialogue. He knew Harris wouldn't sugarcoat his answer.
"Same as everyone else," Bill said. "It's tough when a goal gets pushed back on you. But this is what we're here for, right?"
"Exactly. I especially want to know how this has affected Andy Gangle."
"Since he can't wander outside anymore, he's pretty much stayed in his room. To be honest, I haven't seen him in 12 or more hours. The last time was in the rec room. He was just passing through. I asked him how he was. He muttered fine and kept on going."
"Would you say his antisocial behavior has gotten worse?"
"No," Bill said. "It's about the same. He was antisocial when he got here, and he's antisocial now."
"I know you've mentioned you've tried to engage him over the last few months. Has anyone else?"
"If someone has, they've been shot down. I said before, I think the screeners who allowed him to winter down here made a mistake. He's not cut out for this kind of isolation. At least not as a functioning part of a team."
"But Bill," Parker said, leaning closer to his laptop camera for emphasis, "what happens if you're on the space station or halfway to the moon when you realize that the doctors who screened your crewmates made a similar mistake?"
"Are you saying you're going to screw up?" Harris asked with a chuckle.
"No," Parker grinned. "But the other members of the screening committee might. So what would you do?"
"Above all else, make sure the person is pulling their weight. If they don't want to talk much, fine, but they have to do their job."
"And if they refuse?" Bill Harris suddenly looked over his shoulder, as if he'd heard something.
"What is it?" the psychiatrist asked.
"Sounded like a gunshot," Harris replied.
"I'll be right back."
Parker watched the astronaut get up from his chair. He
He was halfway to the open door of his room on the remote ice station when a sudden blur moved across the threshold. Harris staggered back, and then something hit the webcam, and Parker's view was completely blocked. He watched for several seconds. Soon the blackness on his laptop took on a faint purplish cast. As more time elapsed, the view turned lighter and lighter, going from the deepest plum to light eggplant, and finally to red. It took him a moment to realize what had hit the camera was a clot of blood that then oozed off the lens. Parker could make out few details because of the bloody film, but there was no sign of Bill Harris, and the audio feed was picking up the unmistakable wail of a woman screaming. A full minute elapsed before her voice was cut off abruptly. Parker kept watching, but when something passed the doorway again, it was an indistinct blur. It certainly looked like the outline of a man, but it was impossible to know who. He double-checked that his computer was automatically recording, as he did all sessions with his distant patient. Everything was safely on the hard drive. As a precaution, he emailed the first part of the file to himself so he had backup imagery and CC'd his boss. Leaving his computer recording the now-silent webcam at Wilson George Base, he picked up his phone and dialed his supervisor's direct line. Keith Deaver. Keith, it's Tom. We've got a situation at Wilson George. Check the email I just sent. Forward through the file until the last 5 minutes. Call me back when you're done. 6 minutes later, Tom snatched up the handset before it had finished its first ring. What do you think? I know for a fact there aren't any guns on that station, but I'm positive that was a gunshot. I think so, too, Parker replied. To be sure, we need an expert to listen to it. Do that stuff like you see on the cop shows. This is bad, Keith. I don't know if you overheard Bill and I talking, but McMurdo can't send in a plane for a week or more, not even to do a visual reconnaissance. Who has lead on that place? Penn State is monitoring it full time, if that's what you mean. Do you have a contact there?
Yes. I think his name's Benton.
Yeah, that's it, Steve Benton. He's a climatologist or something. Call him. See if their telemetry is still coming through. Also, see if they have other webcams up and running right now. We should get in touch with McMurdo. Let them know what's happening and see if they really can't get an aircraft to Wilson George sooner.
I have a contact there, too, Palmer said, at the U.S. Antarctic Program. They're run through the National Science Foundation.
Okay. I want hourly updates. And make sure someone's watching your computer from now on. I'll send you warm bodies if you need them.
I'll get my secretary in here while I make the calls, but I'll probably take you up on that offer later in the day.
As bureaucracies go, the amount of time it took to get things in motion was remarkably short. By the end of the day, a Houston police officer had listened to the audio from the webcam and couldn't determine if the sound was a gun or not. He gave it a 75% assurance that it was, but wouldn't say definitively. The tower dispatcher at McMurdo confirmed that all their planes were grounded due to weather, and no emergency was grave enough to risk a flight crew. Conditions were even worse at Palmer Station, the only other American base on the Antarctic Peninsula, so there was no chance of them checking in on Wilson George. Feelers had gone out to other nations with research centers nearby, but the closest was an Argentine research facility, and, despite the common bonds among the scientific community, they had rebuffed the request in no uncertain terms. By 8 o'clock that evening, the news of the situation had been sent to the president's national security advisor. Because Wilson George was so close to an Argentine base, and there was inconclusive evidence of gunfire, there was the possibility they had been attacked for some reason. Ideas were discussed late into the night, and a request was sent to the National Reconnaissance Office for a satellite to be retasked in order to photograph the isolated research station. By dawn, the pictures had been analyzed, and even their remarkable optics were defeated by the storm that was savaging half the continent. And then, like all bureaucracies, the efficiency stopped there. No one knew what to do next. All the information that could be gathered and studied had been. A decision was needed, but no one could be found who was willing to make it. The early surge of activity came to an abrupt end
and the people involved began to take a wait-and-see attitude. When he arrived at Langley a little past 9, Langston Overholt took a cup of coffee his secretary had ready for him and went into his private office. The view through the bulletproof window behind him caught a copse of trees in full leaf. The wind danced along the branches and made fractal shadows on the lawn below. His office was Spartan. Unlike many other senior officers at the CIA, Overholt didn't have an ego wall, a collection of photographs of himself and various dignitaries. He had never seen the need to advertise his importance to others. But with his legendary reputation, it really wasn't necessary. Anyone visiting him here on the 7th floor knew exactly who he was. And while many of his accomplishments remain deeply buried secrets, enough had leaked out over the years to secure his status within the agency. There were only a few photographs on the wall, mostly portraits done during the holidays as his family grew, and one sepia-toned snapshot of him and a young Asian man. Only an expert would recognize that he was Tibet's Dalai Lama. "Well, maybe a little ego," he said, glancing at the picture. Overholt read the briefing report given to all senior staffers. It was an even more thorough version than that given to the president, who'd early in his administration made it clear that he didn't like to bother with details. There was the usual news from around the world. A bombing in Iraq, oil workers killed in Nigeria, North Korean military posturing along the DMZ. The incident at the Wilson George station raided a paragraph on the second-to-last page, just below remarks about the near capture of a Serbian war criminal. Had this taken place at any other Antarctic base, he wouldn't have given it a second thought, but the report made it clear that the Argentines had a facility about 30 miles away, and their terse refusal to send out a team to investigate set Overholt's sixth sense into high gear. He requested the raw footage from Dr. Palmer's webcam. He knew immediately what had to be done. He checked in with the director of the South American section and was told that Cabrillo had reached Asuncion the night before and turned over the power cell to a pair of agency couriers, and it was now on a charter flight nearing the California coast. Overholt killed the internal call and dialed Houston to speak with Dr. Parker. After that, he placed a call to an overseas exchange.